listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live today from AM 760, Chicago's Progressive Talk, in Denver, the Mile High City. And just a quick heads up on what's up this week. On tomorrow, Tuesday, I will be at 7:30 p.m. I'll be at the Tattered Cover Bookstore here in downtown Denver. It's at 1628 16th Street, Denver. The Tattered Cover, that's tomorrow night at 7:30. Wednesday night, November 20th, at 7 p.m., I'll be at the LeMay Monica Theater in Santa Monica. Thursday at noon, I'll be at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco. Friday in Portland at 7:30 p.m., I'll be at Powell's Bookstore. And then the following Tuesday, I'll be at Politics and Prose in D.C. So all of that is over at TomHartman.com. You can track it all down. We're doing the book tour for the book The Crash of 2016. Speaking of crashes and their impact on people, Eno Schmidt is with us. He's the founder of the Basic Income Movement. I would say the original founder of this, the guy who wrote about it in Agrarian Justice, was Thomas Paine back in the 1790s. Eno's website is bedingungsschloss.ch. Do I have that right, Eric? Or Eno?
Hi, Tom.
Hello.
My website, yeah, that's grundeinkommen.ch.
Okay. I have bedingungsschloss.
Yes, okay, too.
Okay, that works, too. How do you say that word?
What?
Bedingungsschloss? .ch? Anyway, it doesn't matter. The links are over at our homepage, TomHartman.com. You know, what is the basic movement, the basic income movement?
The basic income movement in Switzerland starts with two people, with Daniel and me. We are together the founders of this initiative. And it grows up rather quickly, but it has interest by a lot of people. And so we went to this people initiative, and that is successful now. And so the people in Switzerland will vote about it. And the idea, you said it before, Thomas Paine, for example, is one of the big, great thinker of this, human rights combined with an unconditional basic income. And so Milton Friedman, for example, in the States, or Martin Luther King, that are fathers of this idea. And this idea is changing, and it grows up again at the beginning of this century in Germany and other countries. And the meaning of this idea, I think, is not first to do something against poorness. It's not first a program for social benefits, but it is to say, what is the idea of democracy? Isn't it that everybody is able to decide by him or herself what is right or wrong for society and for themselves? And let's set us free the living, to live and to decide how you want to lead your life. And on the other hand, we are in a new situation, what was never before, that we have enough goods worldwide. It's not the problem that we don't have it, but it's the problem how we think about it. And therefore, this initiative for me is a cultural impulse, much more than a business or a poorness or social thing, but a cultural impulse to think the relations new, to rethink society.
We're talking with Eno Schmidt. He is the co-founder of the Basic Income Movement in Switzerland. He's coming to us live from Switzerland via telephone. And the Swiss are the people of your country are going to vote on whether to give everybody in the country a basic income, whether they work or not, regardless of what their income is, if that's my understanding correctly. Can you tell me what the amounts are, how this works?
Yeah, the amount is, for example, 2,500 francs. That means in
per month, per year, per what?
A month for every adult, and okay. Children maybe a quarter of that.
2,500 Swiss francs a month would be about what? $3,500
US
dollars?
No, You can't change this by the number. So that 2,000 francs is such dollars. It is to live without need. And what that is.
No, what I meant, you know, for our American listeners is in dollars, what would be the equivalent amount to what the 2,500 Swiss francs that you're talking about giving each person each month? What would that equivalent be?
Yeah, that's the question to your listeners. What is that in the United States? What is enough to live without need? What is the amount? Maybe it's $1,800. I don't know that exactly. In Switzerland, it's a minimum to have 2,500 francs. It's better to have 3,000 that are the social welfare in the moment for the people. Mm-hmm. So the thought is to live, to have money to live. And what that is in Hungarian or Russia or the United States, it's different because of the prices are different and the purchase power of the money.
Right. Okay.
So, for example, you can say, let's say $2,000, I don't know. What is the minimum income in the States?
$7.25 an hour.
And that makes it the month?
A little more than $1,000 a month.
Yeah, then that would be an example to start to think about.
Right. Because 2,000 Swiss francs would be about 2,200 U.S. dollars per month.
Yeah, that is changing, but to the prices.
Yeah, I just looked it up. 2,741 would be your 2,500.
And the second was...
As you point out, the cost of living is different. I'm sorry, go ahead.
The question about what is with work, did I understood it right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that is the main question, first of all, the question how it is to finance and what is with work. And some of your colleagues in the States wrote, if you pay people by doing nothing, they will do nothing. And that is a misunderstanding of this basic income. It is not wage. It is not to be paid for. It is not to give and to become. So this thinking, what is right by labor income, by all this, what we are usual do, it is different to this unconditional basic income, what is not for anything, not ordering anything, and also not ordering do nothing. Mm-hmm. It is free money. It is a new kind and a new thought of an income what secures your life and not what orders you or do anything else with you than to set the people free to do what they really do. And then imagine what people are doing, even without being paid, without payment. For example, all this work in family with children, free work in sports and so on, it's all done without payment. And it's not true that the people is really in every time bounded by how many money I get by this work. And when I talk with entrepreneurs in Switzerland and other countries, they all say 70% of my people in my company, they are working because they are engaged and bound and together in this society, we do sensible things for other people. And that is sense by doing things that is that's the result.
We have about a half a minute left. When is the vote and how does it look?
The vote is in 2 to 4 years.
Uh-huh.
And then if the majority say yes, the government is ordered to start to implement it.
And what's public opinion right now?
And what's?
What is public opinion? How many people support this?
We have 126,000 signatures for this initiative. And we need more than half of the people who will vote. How many that will be, it's open.
Yeah. Okay, Ino Schmidt, a founder of the Basic Income Movement. You can find his links to his websites over at tomhartman.com. Ino, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Very good talking with you. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Should we have a basic income movement in the United States? Thomas Paine thought so and tried to influence George Washington. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Amy, watching Free Speech TV in Madison, Wisconsin. Hey, Amy, what's up?
Oh, there's developments in the Doe Reservation investigation against Scott Walker.
Oh, great. Tell me about it.
For the first time, a source is speaking, mm-hmm. and 29 organizations are being in targeted, including Club for Growth, the Republican Governors Association, Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce, Americans for Prosperity. And they all contributed to the thing. And
these are all
legislatures.
These are all Koch brother funded in part or entirely organizations, if my recollection is correct.
They all got subpoenas. And when, well, this is in the State Journal, when they called for comment, they refused comment. But I think Club for Growth admitted being a subpoena.
Right.
And the Liberal Center for Media and Democracy, like, composed all the millions of dollars each group gave.
Right.
And they're really interested in the issue ads, whether they collaborated
right.
with the campaign.
Right. Great. Amy, I'm gonna dig this out, and we will report this in more detail. Thank you for the tip, and thanks for the heads up. I appreciate
okay,
the call.
Okay, thanks,
Tom.
I got your book today.
Oh, great. Well, let me know what you think of it. Thank you, Amy. I got to run. Thank you for the call. Nate Sweet is with us, producer of The Big Picture, which will be on tonight at 7 o'clock Eastern time. And I'll be doing live here from Denver. Nate, what's on the show tonight?
Hey, how's it going, Tom? We'll be starting off with a special Monday edition of the Big Picture Rumble. We're going to be talking about the potential of a Bernie Sanders run for president, which I think should have a lot of your viewers excited. He came on as your radio listeners probably already know, he came on the show for Brunch with Bernie on Friday and seemed to allude that he was interested if he thought his viewpoints could get out into the, or if he was the only person available that could get those important viewpoints out into the election, he would do it. We'll also be talking about ALEC is ramping up its new model legislation, which is a gutting of the 17th Amendment. And for those people who don't know, the 17th Amendment was passed through 1913, established for the first time the direct election of U.S. senators. Before
right.
that, they were voted on by the
right.
state legislature.
People were so horrified by, what was his name, the Copper Baron in Montana?
Oh man, we talked about this about 2 weeks ago.
Yeah,
name slipped my mind, but Mark Twain wrote about him, said some pretty nasty things.
Yeah, William Clark comes to mind, but I could be wrong. But yeah, Mark Twain said he was the dastardliest man ever born or something like that. But anyhow, that's what provoked the 17th Amendment. And of course,
right.
these guys just want to take us back to that. So what else?
Well, we'll also be talking about the whole controversy with Lynn and Liz Cheney. As many of you know, Liz. One of them happens to be gay, and the other is running for senator. Running for Senate in running for Congress in Wyoming. So it's sort of an interesting
for Mike Enzi's seat, yeah.
Right?
She's trying to unseat a sitting
right.
Republican.
Yeah, and it's sort of an interesting snapshot of the difficulties that the Republican Party finds itself in today. So,
we're going to have that. We're going to have Lamar Waldron is going to be with us talking about the JFK assassination. We're going to be talking about carbon taxes.
Thomas Stoner.
Yeah, Thomas Stoner. It's going to be he really should be working for Normal with a name like that. It's going to be a great day. So catch up with us on the show tonight. I'll be doing that live from Denver as well. Thanks, Nate.
Thanks, Tom.
Good talking with you. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you live from Denver, where we're broadcasting, and a tip of the hat and thanks to Dan and everybody else involved here at AM 760 Colorado's Progressive Talk, loaning us a studio for a couple of days to do our show from today and tomorrow. And tomorrow night here in Denver, 7:30 Mountain Time, 7:30 local time, I will be signing The Crash of 2016 at the Tattered Cover Bookstore. And then Wednesday in Santa Monica, in Los Angeles area, I'll be at the Lemmy, I think it's spelled L-A-E-M-M-I-E, Monica Theater. And on Thursday, I'll be at the Common, and that's at 7 o'clock Wednesday. Thursday at noon at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco. That's Thursday, the 21st of November. Friday, 7:30 p.m. in Portland, I'll be at Powell's Bookstore on Burnside, the main Powell's Bookstore. So that's what's up. I'm on the road, barely figuring out what day it is. Okay, let me just explain. First of all, yeah, there's a lot of stuff sort of in the news. I think one of the more interesting ones is, I went off on this rant last week about how in A Christmas Carol, the story by Charles Dickens, about how Charles Dickens was, you know, he was a small businessman, and he had one employee, Bob Cratchit, and he had this experience with these ghosts. He had this transformation, and he went from being a low-wage employer to a decent-wage employer. And at the very end of the book, and you might not have read the book. I read it on the air here. I don't have it in front of me right now, but I read it, part of it, on the air. And at the end of the book, and sometimes in the movie, sometimes not. Usually in the movie, this part isn't referred to. But in the various movies and TV adaptations, and who knows why, maybe, well, whatever. At the very end, what Scrooge does is he gives Bob Cratchit a raise. That's what he does for Christmas. Not just a raise, but a raise so that Bob can make enough money that he can pay for medical care for Tiny Tim, for his entire family, and he can have a decent standard of living. A substantial raise that Ebenezer Scrooge gives to Bob Cratchit at the end of A Christmas Carol. And I was contrasting that with Walmart saying that for their employees who work on Thanksgiving, they're going to give them a coupon good for a discount shopping trip, and they're going to give them a Thanksgiving dinner, and presumably in the back of the store or something. I don't know how it's working. But in Canton, Ohio, according to the Cleveland Plain Dealer, a Walmart has set up back in the employee area a box so that employees can give canned foods to other Walmart employees, right? So Walmart is saying to the underpaid workers at Walmart, hey, if you got a little extra food at home, some of these other underpaid workers got nothing. You know, kick in something. Incredible. Incredible. Rob Ford is up to his normal insanity. I don't think I even need to comment on that. George Zimmerman has been arrested for perhaps domestic abuse in the context of a dispute with his girlfriend. And the Republicans now, oh, and Liz Cheney now, this is so bizarre. She's trashing her own sister, Mary. Mary is gay and is a lesbian and is married. And Liz Cheney, you know, wants to take Mike Enzi's seat in Congress, and the Republican from Wyoming. And so, I mean, Liz, who's spent her whole life in Virginia, in D.C., in the Beltway, has moved out to Wyoming, tried to get a fishing license. You've got to live there for 10 months or a year or something. They wouldn't give it to her. And so that she could be I'm a fishing gal, right? And now she's saying, I don't like gay marriage. Yeah, my sister's gay. She's married. To heck with her. I think this just shows the sociopathy of the Cheney family. I mean, this is a family that's headed by a guy, Dick Cheney, who helped lie us into a war that killed thousands and thousands of Americans and hundreds of thousands of Iraqis, displaced 5 million people, destroyed valuable archaeological treasures, flipped Iraq from being a stable Sunni government, wasn't the greatest government on earth, but a stable Sunni government, to a very unstable Shiite government that has now aligned itself with Iran. I mean, and Dick Cheney hasn't even apologized for lying to us. In fact, he brags about it. And meanwhile, you've got the Republicans running around going, well, Obama lied about whether or not you could keep the policy. Well, actually, no, he didn't. But he didn't say it probably the way he should have said it, particularly knowing, you know, what the Republicans were going to do. But the problem that the Republicans have is they have no alternative. They got nothing. But they're running around now. This is the meme, you know, the memo that must have come down during in Fox News. Is something to the effect of, on one of the in testimony before Congress, Kathleen Sebelius was asked, you know, there are these navigators, right? There's money in the Obamacare to hire people to help people sign up, right? They're basically they help you sign up for health insurance. And so one of the Republican senators said, is there anything in the law that prevents from felons from becoming navigators? And apparently the whole navigator thing has been outsourced because Kathleen Sebelius's response was, no, there's nothing in the law, but the companies that we work with are very carefully vetting the people that they hire. Now, the Republicans chose to ignore that part of it. And Fox News, right-wing talk, everything. Oh, do you want to be giving your Social Security number to a felon, really, huh? Is that it? Hey, note to Republicans. Call your credit card company and just ask what your balance is. You know, they'll ask you personal questions like when was your, you know, when were you born? What's your mother's married name? What's your Social Security? You know, to prove that you're you, give you your balance. Odds are about 20-25% that you're talking to somebody inside a jail in the United States. And if you're not talking to somebody inside a jail, you're talking to somebody in the Philippines where they have no laws against identity theft. Or at least they didn't 6 months ago when the story broke. So Obamacare, Navigate, somebody's going to walk me through how to get health insurance. They're going to steal my personal. Come on, give me a break. But the Republicans, they're flailing.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I mean, the Republicans have got nothing. Anyhow, Tom Hartman broadcasting live from AM 760, Colorado's Progressive Talk, will be at the Tattered Coverage tomorrow night at 7:30. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you and live from Denver, where we're doing our show today from the studios of AM 760, Colorado's Progressive Talk. And tomorrow, and I will be doing the show here tomorrow as well. And tomorrow night, Tuesday night, the 19th of November at 7:30, if you're in the Denver area, I'll be at the Tattered Cover Bookstore and signing books, signing The Crash of 2016. That's tomorrow, Tuesday. Wednesday, I'll be in Santa Monica. Thursday, I'll be in San Francisco. Friday, I will be in Portland. And the following Tuesday, I'll be in Washington, D.C. You can find it all at TomHartman.com. So check it out. I opened the show with a fellow from Switzerland who is putting together this basic minimum income. And a good website for this, by the way, is basicincome2013.eu. And it's about, here's how it works, really simple. Everybody gets a check every month that is the basic amount to live on. Not at, you know, screaming poverty, oh, I can't make, you know, like right now with food stamps. And I mean, you get all the government benefits right now, and people are still having to go without food the last 3 or 4 days of every month, or they're having not to use their pharmaceuticals or whatever. This would be enough. I mean, the Swiss are talking about 2,500 Swiss francs, and a dollar ten is roughly equal to a Swiss franc right now. So, you know, it's $2,700 roughly. And so, or a Swiss franc is equal to $1.10, or the other way around, whatever it is. Anyhow, it's the net of this is what they're saying is, let's give everybody a basic guaranteed minimum income. Now, on the surface, this sounds like kind of a crazy idea, right? I mean, why would you do that? You know, what would make that happen? But the idea is actually, like I said, it's one that Thomas Paine started out with, and it actually would work quite well. They have over on their website, I'm looking at the EU website, they click on the countries for details. The point of it is that, first of all, you raise the standard of living in everybody. Secondly, you stimulate the economy. You increase demand. Third, you wipe out poverty. There's no need for us to have poverty in this world. There's plenty to go around. There really is. It's just that, you know, there's a bunch of billionaires that have hoarded it. It's like on the TV show, The Hoarders. So give everybody a basic minimum income. And, you know, a lot of people, most people will continue to work. They like what they're doing, and they like the extra income. Some people might just loaf, but they're loafing, you know, goofing off gets boring really fast. I was on unemployment once, and I started a business. I probably could have found a job, but I thought it would be more fun to start a business. It's like, you know, that was back in the day when you could buy a health insurance policy from Blue Cross Blue Shield with, you know, pre-existing conditions irrelevant for $30 and $35 a month. And it was just, you know, simple stuff. But anyway, Thomas Paine proposed this. I think it's a good idea. And I want to get into it a little more detail as time goes on. Bob in Tahlequah, Oklahoma. Hey, Bob, you want to agree on that?
Yeah, hi, Tom. I'm glad you had the man on from Switzerland.
You know,
Thomas Paine's point was not that people get, you know, fast forward, not that people get a check from the government, but they have a right to grow what they want to grow on their property, which relates directly to the cannabis plant in modern times. Now,
well, no, Bob, Thomas Paine's suggestion was that at birth, Thomas Paine's suggestion was that at, it, read it, you can read it in Agrarian Justice.
No, I've
was,
read that. I'm
was
talking
that at
about
birth,
right now
every
what it
person
means, relevant to the modern day society we live in. Cannabis prohibition is just evil. And I think we're kind of unwinding that, but I don't know. Are people in Colorado out in the eastern part of the state, are they growing big fields of industrial hemp at the same time that these marijuana growers want to grow their little patches and their little laboratories? Because
I don't know, Bob. I'll check around and find out. Thomas Paine's suggestion was that at birth, the government give a small amount of money to every person and invest it for them, presumably in the equivalent of treasuries, although they didn't have that at the time. Or perhaps they did, I don't know. And that by the time that person became an adult, they would have a pile of money on which they could, from which they could live. They could draw from that pile of money in times of need, and they could live off the interest throughout the rest of their lives. And that was that shtick. Mark Taylor Canfield has an update on the election in Seattle. As we know, it was mostly vote by mail. In fact, it was entirely vote by mail, wasn't it, Mark?
Yes, you could actually drop off your ballots at designated drop-off boxes.
Right, but there were no voting machines. There was
no
stations you had to go to. There was no way that the Republicans could make the lines 12 hours long. So because it was vote by mail, it took a while for all the mail to get delivered and opened and read or tabulated. And you've got an update on your socialist candidate, your Occupy candidate.
Yeah, there's actually several issues. Before I get to that, I should let people know that the genetically modified organism labeling campaign, which is Initiative 522, is still losing. But by maybe 1%, it's 51 against 49% for. So it's very, very close.
What percentage are still uncounted?
Not many, but one of the things that our new socialist city council member, Kasama Swan, was saying is that they are looking for, quote, unverified votes. In other words, people are sending in their ballot, and then there's a way of checking to make sure that your ballot has been counted. I talked to someone just the other day, a good friend of mine, and he said that his vote has not been verified yet. In other words, he has not got confirmation from the Secretary of State that it's been counted.
Hmm.
But Initiative 522 is still losing, and they're still counting some votes, but there's not many left. Hmm. The other issue that got a lot of national attention here was the SeaTac Proposition 1. SeaTac is a city just south of Seattle. They want to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour. And at that point, that's still actually winning, but by less than 200 votes.
Whoa.
Actually, it's less than 100 votes at this point with the last count.
Wow.
So things are very, very close. And then in Seattle, we have Proposition 1 also, which is public financing of city elections. And that, surprisingly, now at this point, is losing by about 200 votes. So that's a switch. But the big news is that yesterday, the Occupy candidate, the self-proclaimed Occupy candidate, and the avowed socialist, Kasama Sawant, who's a teacher at Seattle Center Community College, has declared victory. She had a huge standing room only crowd at the SEIU Union Hall yesterday in downtown Seattle. And she gave her speech. She warned everyone, she warned the media that I'm going to give a long speech here. And then she quoted Noam Chomsky saying that if you're going to fight the status quo, you can't speak in sound bites.
Mm.
But during her campaign victory election speech, she did thank the Occupy movement. She also thanked a lot of small local businesses who supported her. And she is saying that her main priority is going to be raising the minimum wage in Seattle to $15 an hour. She also said that there will be a statewide initiative on that issue next year. They're already planning to do that. So she's actually tying into a larger issue that doesn't just encompass Seattle. But it was a switch in the vote count. As I said before in your show, she had actually conceded to me the night of the election. But now she's victorious, and Richard Conlon gave his concession speech the other day. He was very gracious, said he really appreciated her grassroots.
Is she a socialist the way that Bernie Sanders is, as in Northern European democratic socialism, or is she a socialist in the way that Marx used the word in a more pure sense, or is she a socialist in the way that it was practiced by the former Soviet states?
Well, she is a member of the Socialist Alternative Party.
Mm-hmm.
So anybody can check that out. You can go to socialistalternative.org. And they are a national group. They ran a candidate for the Minneapolis City Council race as well. And that was Ty Moore. And he barely lost that election. So he also surprised a lot of people. But, you know, to tell you the truth, Tom, I haven't interviewed her, really deeply on her socialist beliefs. She seems to be interested in using the political system as it is to get these issues across.
Sure.
So far, her identity as a socialist has not really been a big issue in the campaign. In fact, I looked around the crowd and I saw folks from the King County Labor Council there, from the Sierra Club. There were lots of more mainstream type groups that are now supporting her just because she's brought in so much hope to politics in the Northwest and in Seattle especially, because there were a lot of people who kind of dropped out of the political system, especially during the Occupy movement, who now feel that they have a candidate who actually represents their issues. And, she had a very highly organized and effective election campaign. I'm writing about this over at Truth Out and Daily Coast. But she said that she was advised at one point by some political consultants to drop the socialist label. But she told me, quote, I think I've been successful because I'm an authentic candidate and I stood up for what I believe that's
right.
What the voters want.
I'd say the same is true of Bernie. And on our program on Friday, Bernie said that, if nobody is representing those values in the upcoming presidential election in 2016, that he's willing to step in and participate, which was really dropped my jaw. That's really remarkable. So good on her. Mark Taylor Canfield, thanks for the update.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Broadcasting live from Denver, AM 760, where tomorrow night at 7:30, I'll be at the Tattered Cover signing Crash of 2016. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Will in Madison, Wisconsin. Hey, Will, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I was going to mention something about Ellen Brown. She's an attorney. She's got a great book, Web of Debt, and a number of other books. And you probably may have had her on. But
yes.
You may be surprised to know that my grandfather and Gus Hallberg were the two men who started the Humane Work Week in the world. Let me explain how that happened.
Okay.
Gus Hallberg, Hall, he had to have three last names because he was on list to be murdered for starting the IWW.
Oh, this is the notorious or famous Gus Hall who started the Wobblies.
Yep, IWW, International Workers of the World. And my grandfather was the other one, Oscar Sandstrom. He had four last names to prevent from being shot, Sandstrom, Strum, Stremd, and Strand. And two first names, Oscar and Alex. That was the deal. They brought up organized crime from Chicago to kill, murder the marchers, the leaders forming the unions, the Humane Work Week in the world, and also the organized crime from Detroit up to the Upper Peninsula to kill those that were organizing the copper miners in UP. And that is how the Humane Work Week got started in the world. And I'm proud to say, I'm almost 80 now, to know that my grandfather was one of the two that were real activists to get the ball rolling to bring a Humane Work Week to the world. And if I may add, how did they get involved in that? Because, I'll make it short, the Tsar controlled much of the areas of northern Russia, parts of Sweden, and he was having the Finns and Swedes work like slaves, 7 days a week, 14 hours a day in the 1880s. They went on strike. It was a bitter strike. The Tsar thought he might be overthrown, so he gave him a bone. You don't have to work 7 days a week, 14 hours a day. You only have to work 6 days a week, 10 hours a day. Be happy. They won that strike. Some of them came to America, worked in the copper mines, in the iron ore mines, and the timber industry in northern Wisconsin. They went on strike in 1905, and it was a bitter strike. But they won, and that is how we, all the people of the world, now have a humane work week, five-day week, eight-hour day. Sadly now, many can't work 8 hours. They only, 5 day a week, they only work 29 hours a week just so the big corporations don't have to pay their health care.
Yeah, Will, correct me if I'm wrong. Back at that time, the humane work week was a 50-hour week, wasn't it?
It was a 40-hour week.
It was a 40-hour week. Okay. I thought the 40-hour week came after World War II.
And I'm from up there. I'm calling from Madison, Wisconsin, but that's the way it is. But you might be right. You know, 50 hours, 40 hours, hey, it's a lot better than working 7 days a week, 14 hours a day. I'll tell you that much.
Oh, yeah.
So, but, you know, I just wish that people would understand how we have gotten our humane work week. There were people who dared to struggle for, you know, getting humaneness into the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And people who not only dared to struggle, people who died. And, the goons came after them. You're right. Will, thank you for the little bit of history there. I appreciate it. And thanks for watching the show in Madison. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Marvin here with you, broadcasting live from AM 760, Colorado's Progressive Talk, here in the Mile High City, where tomorrow night I'll be at the Tattered Cover signing my new book, The Crash of 2016. We're on book tour right now. And picking up your calls, John in Minneapolis. Hey, John.
Yeah, I just wanted to say I was sorry to miss you here in Minneapolis, and I am interested in your book. I haven't bought it yet, but I wanted to say that about the mayoral election in Seattle, this is the first socialist mayor that they ever had, and I've only heard it from you and Amy Goodman. You know, it's not really out there in the popular press out in CNN, and I haven't heard it anywhere else. But I think people are really ready for a change. There was a lot of excitement for her election, and a lot of people worked on her campaign, and maybe this is a tide that's turning, and because I think, you know, I've been a lifelong Democrat, and I'm really disgusted with the Democratic Party, but the progressive wing of it I've been interested in, and so I'm interested in anybody that, kind of sparks interest. And that also shows a major concern to the middle class and what we're going through, instead of what corporations go through. I think that, unfortunately what happens with the Democratic Party is they want to get the popular vote and they move, you know, to one side of the spectrum. And then as soon as they're in, they just dump us in favor of, once they win the election. And I think that's why so many people are so disgusted with politics. I just wanted to make that comment.
Yeah. Well, and I'm curious what your thoughts are on Bernie's running.
I think that's wonderful. He reminds me a lot of a senator that we had here in Minnesota who was a populist and a very genuine, warm,
Bob LaFollette
person, Paul Wellstone.
Oh, Paul Wellstone, yeah.
Yeah, Paul Wellstone. And, we've had others in this state, but, I think Paul Wellstone, in recent memory here, was a wonderful person. It was a tragedy that, he died, because he was able to take a very conservative area of the state and turn it, toward him in voting, for him, for senator, which is quite an accomplishment. We're not really as liberal as we like to think we are here in Minnesota, and there's very conservative areas of the state,
He, by just campaigning very traditionally, shaking hands, going out constantly, working, the crowd, and also he was a very genuine person. He, you know, people respond to that, and he did things for people that they remembered, and I think that Bernie Sanders is very much the same kind of person, and he would have my support, hands down. I would love that.
I
think that people are ready for somebody like Bernie Sanders that would take leadership in supporting progressive values instead of having us marginalized.
We need a loud voice, standing up for the people of America. I won't even say the left; it's the people of America. And if that voice is not there, not loud is probably the wrong word. A strong voice. And Bernie is that voice in my mind. John, thanks for the call. Nolan in Haley, Idaho. Hey, Nolan, what's up?
Hey, what's going on? Look, I wanted to comment on what you were talking about with giving people money. I actually, when we did the stimulus, I was wondering why, instead of the government giving the banks and big business a stimulus, how come they didn't give it to the American people?
Well, during the George W. Bush stimulus right after 9/11, at Bernie Sanders' suggestion.
I'm not talking about the $300 one.
They passed out $300.
Obama did his. Why didn't we get a stimulus? We would have used that in the economy.
Mm-hmm.
Big business doesn't want they don't want us to succeed. They want to succeed. They don't want the common person in America to succeed. It's only obvious by the way they treat you.
Mm-hmm. I agree. They don't want a powerful middle class, because if they have a powerless middle class, they have more power. They don't want a powerful government either, because then they have more power. It's all about filling the public space with billionaires and corporate money and corporate power rather than we the people. That's it. Nolan, thanks for the call. Joe in Chicago. Hey, Joe.
Hi, I was just calling about your history lesson regarding the idea of giving people money when they're born.
Mm-hmm.
And
Thomas Paine's idea. Yeah.
Yes, I think it's a great idea, because we have this horrible problem with the revolving door criminal justice system, of people mm-hmm. cycling in and out of prisons and mental health hospitals.
Right.
And one possible solution, seems to me, is if we gave people a trust fund when they were born that could accumulate, so when they finish high school, that could be used to pay for their college, vocational education.
Oh, their college should be free.
Service if needed, or their prison if they elect to go to prison. That would, maybe you could use the same budget we spend to keep people in prison, but potentially pay for them to go to college instead.
Yeah. Isn't it amazing that we have more prisoners now than students?
It's incredible, and the cost is just intolerable.
Yeah, it's insane. The rest of the country is looking at us going, what is wrong with these people? Thanks, Joe. Excellent comment. Lillian in Lockford, California. Hey, Lillian.
Hi, Tom. I think the previous speaker had the same idea I had, that income and crime can go together, and if we have a living income, we would have empty beds in some of our prisons.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We would have empty beds in a lot of our prisons, and we would have people doing things that aren't so well paid but actually contribute massively to society, like producing music and producing art and, doing things, becoming performers and musicians and artists and writers. And, people would be free to follow their passions. And when they follow their passions, society gets better. I mean, this is just a long history of we know this. And I think this guaranteed minimum income and not making it the poverty level like, welfare in the United States, but, a lower middle income, lower middle class, not, what you need to live a life of dignity, be able to afford food in most countries you don't have to afford pharmaceuticals for free. But, afford new clothes and a car and a decent place to live. Very simple stuff. Very simple stuff. Lillian, thank you very much for the call. Great to hear from you. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends. Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. Edison Factor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartmann.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartmann.com. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you, broadcasting live today from AM 760, Colorado's Progressive Talk in Denver, where I will also be tomorrow doing our radio show from here. And tomorrow night, we will be at the Tattered Cover Bookstore at 7:30 p.m. And, you know, it's a free event, and I will be doing a pretty good rant. I've done it twice now. I did it in Chicago on Thursday or Friday. I did it in Minneapolis, yesterday or the day before? And as you know, I have no sense of time whatsoever. And we're doing it, and I'm doing it tomorrow. So I'm fine-tuning this thing. And it was really nice. Minneapolis was great. And in fact, C-SPAN showed up. So we may see this on Book TV as well. So, but tomorrow night at the Tattered Cover. In our studios in Washington, D.C., is with us Graham Robb, who is an historian and the author of the book The Discovery of Middle Earth. And I have not read the entire book, but I have read pieces of it. I've read about it, and this seemed so profoundly fascinating to me that I wanted to get him on. Graham, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. It's nice to be here.
Thanks for joining us. Middle Earth, what is it?
Middle Earth is not just the land inhabited by hobbits. It's a concept that's common to several mythologies, including Celtic mythology, also Norse mythology, which Tolkien used for The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings. Mm. And I thought, since I studied and taught at Tolkien's College in Oxford, I should be the one to recover that idea for Celtic mythology, which is where it came from. The idea is that the earth we live on is the Middle Earth. There's also the Earth underneath, the underworld, and the upper world, the heavens, the sky above us.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why Middle Earth. It's originally the Celtic concept, which Tolkien knew when he used it and adapted it for his own fantasy world.
So tell us the story of the Celts.
The story of the Celts. Well, how many?
Story of the discovery of Middle Earth. My understanding is that this is were the Celts smarter than we thought, basically?
They were a lot more sophisticated than we thought. And the problem is that we have adopted the Roman view of the Celts. And the Romans wanted to make the Celts look ridiculous because they were afraid of them. The Celts, this is something that's often forgotten, had conquered Rome.
If I may... my recollection is that roughly 3,000 years ago, the Celts conquered Europe and organized it for trading, let people keep their religions and their languages by and large. Then 2,000 years ago, the Romans conquered Europe and let people keep their religions but not their languages by and large. And then 1,000 years ago, basically the Catholics conquered Europe and wiped out all the old religions. Is that thumbnail history? Is there any accuracy to that?
Yes, there is, because the Romans certainly conquered most of what's now Europe. Mm-hmm. But the Celts did have wars of conquest, but mm-hmm. Celts were a huge group of very diverse tribes. You know, there's no Celtic DNA. There was never a single group who were known as the Celts. Celt was simply the word that was applied to most of the inhabitants of Western Europe. And when we talk about the Celts, we're talking about people who had a similar religion, similar language, and similar art, which we still recognize as Celtic art.
Now, is that language the language that has been revived in Ireland?
Yeah, it's Irish, Gaelic and Gaelic mm-hmm. and other Celtic languages, Breton, mm-hmm. are directly related to
what's
ancient
the, what's the root language for Celtic?
Well, there was a language known as Continental Celtic, which mysteriously died out in about the 6th century AD. And we know very few phrases of it. In fact, almost the only complete sentence of ancient Continental Celtic that we know is Nata Vimpi Cormida, which means pretty girl, give me some beer.
the perfect one to remember.
Which is interesting because it shows that even relatively uneducated people who drank beer instead of wine were literate, because it's often said that the Celts were illiterate, and clearly they weren't. They could read and write.
Right. And my understanding, my recollection is, and again, I apologize for not having read your book before this interview. I tried not to do that, but that the Celts were principally interested in organizing trade as opposed to building empire like the Romans did. Does that make sense?
Yes, they had. You could call it a Celtic empire, but it spread by dissemination mm-hmm. rather than conquest. And it's not such an unusual pattern in the ancient world, but it is a lot easier if you're teaching history just to say that one people conquered another. And the most interesting case is Ireland, because archaeologists have shown that no large group settled in Ireland or conquered it in the Celtic period, and yet the people living in Ireland became Celtic. So the question is not where did they come from and who did they beat, but when did Ireland or Britain or France become Celtic?
And when did that happen? It preceded the Romans.
Yes, a long time before the Romans, before there was the Roman Empire. I mean, Rome was just a little settlement on the Tiber.
Right.
Around about 800 BC, certainly by 600 BC, there were tribes living in very different parts of Europe who had what we now recognize as Celtic art.
Are you familiar with the Whig histories and Thomas Jefferson's thoughts on them and debates with David Hume? David Hume, rather? Okay. Because the Whig histories were very popular in the 1770s, and David Hume was trashing them, of course, and Thomas Jefferson was in love with them. And they were all about the tribal people of England, you know, before basically the Norman invasion and the Roman, actually before the Roman invasion. But we're digressing. So what is the most remarkable thing about the Celts that you would like to share with us today?
I think the most remarkable thing is the extent to which they had the same science and technology and capabilities as the ancient Greeks. And it was the Greeks that the Celts were most in contact with. The Greeks colonized Mediterranean France, Gaul, and started dividing the territory up into grids covering many hundreds of square miles. Mm. And this is the basis of the invention that the book describes, which on the surface seems implausible, but actually is not unprecedented.
And that invention is?
The creation of sun lines, I know this sounds very implausible, several hundred miles long, which they used not just to organize their tribal territories, but also to organize their migrations and their military campaigns.
Well, isn't this one of the arguments that that's what Stonehenge is?
Yes, exactly, but on a much smaller scale, just on a local scale. And one reason the Celts seem to have disappeared, although they haven't disappeared for archaeologists, is that they didn't tend to build in stone. These were the hinges of the New Age. They were built by mind instead of muscle. They were ideal lines, like survey lines on which roads were based, because they also had long-distance roads.
Right. And in the last minute we have here, we're talking with Graham Robb, the author of The Discovery of Middle Earth, which is really the story of the Celts. Did they get their science from the Greeks? Did the Greeks get it from them? Where did the Celts come from?
Well, the Celts traded with the Greeks. The Greeks set up colonies along the Mediterranean. And we know that the intellectuals of the Celts, who were called Druids, who weren't just priests, had a 20-year-long education system, and that's how that Greek knowledge penetrated the Celtic world.
Remarkable. Graham Robb, his book, The Discovery of Middle Earth. It's out now from www.norton.com. You can find it over there. And extraordinary. Graham, thanks so much for dropping by.
Thanks very much. It's a pleasure.
Very, very good talking to you. We'll be back. It's 15 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Live from Denver today, where tomorrow I'll be at the Tattered Cover at 7:30 p.m. signing The Crash of 2016. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you and Scott in Corning, New York. Hey, Scott, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's on your mind today?
I bought your book, Crash of 2016.
Right.
And what I was looking for, since I went through the crash of 2006-08, that time period, where might be a good place to put any money you might have invested so the crash doesn't, you know, deplete 50% of it again?
Right.
And I didn't seem to find it in the book. I might have missed it, and that's my question.
Sure. The book is not an investment advice book. It's you know, a macro, a political and macroeconomic book rather than micro. But, you know, I'll take a shot at answering that question. I think that we are in the crash right now. The crash of 2008 was the first 30, 40% of it. And when the rest of it plays out, it's going to play out very much like the crash of 2008. You're going to see the failure of the very large banks. You're going to see the failure of many corporations that are heavily leveraged, that are very much in debt, large corporations that are going to go out of business. Ultimately, that will be a good thing. They'll be replaced by smaller corporations that are debt-free. This is very similar to what happened in 1929, by the way. And so the one place that you can safely put money right now is, although it doesn't earn, you know, this is not for investment, but rather for salvage, is because the FDIC insures individual bank deposits in individual banks up to, I believe it's $250,000. It might be $150,000. I'd have to look it up. I know that there was a change, you know, kind of a temporary change, and I don't know how temporary it was during the last crash. But if you had that amount or less, put it in a bank that is not one of the six big banks. And although even those banks, small depositors, will be protected by the federal government, I'm just guessing that because the banks are so huge, it'll take a lot longer to unwind that stuff and get the money out and through them and through the FDIC and all that. So, you know, what I would do is if I had less than that, I would open an account with a local credit union or a local bank that is FDIC insured, or the credit unions have an equivalent of the FDIC. I forget the acronym, but it's kind of the same thing. And if you have more than that, you know, if you have $500,000 or $1 million or something like that, open 5 or 10 different savings accounts in physically different banks, different name banks, different banks, in your town, small banks, and each one of those will be protected by the FDIC by that limit.
Won't need more than a bank and a half. So
okay.
We're good there.
There you go. So, you know, get a bank and get a credit union, for example, you know, and then you're covered on both sides. There are people who are concerned that the FDIC doesn't have enough money to cover all the claims that would happen if a real big crash was to happen. But frankly, I think the FDIC will be bailed out long before the banks will be bailed out if that were to happen. So that's you know, the best thing. And then the other thing is U.S. Treasuries. Don't buy bond funds. Don't buy them, you know, I wouldn't buy bond funds anyway. I was in TLT for a while. I got out of it. But just you can buy physical bonds. And Republican craziness notwithstanding, I don't think that our government is going to go out of business. And I do believe that our treasuries will be good no matter what. They always have been. So that's the other thing that I would do. Thanks a lot for the call, Scott. And thanks for buying the book. And I hope you find it a good, interesting read. Tom Hartman here with you. We're broadcasting live from Denver, AM 760, and we'll be tomorrow as well. And tomorrow night after we get off the air, I'll be over at the Tattered Cover at 7:30. And I'll be over at the Tattered Cover signing copies of The Crash of 2016 on Wednesday. We'll be in Santa Monica. On Thursday, we'll be in San Francisco. On Friday, we'll be in Portland. And on the following Tuesday, we'll be in Washington, D.C. And you can find it all over at TomHartmann.com, however you spell it. We'll get you there. So that's what's up, and that's where I am, and that's what's going on. And let's see here. Yeah, 20 minutes past the hour. Ben in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Hey, Ben, you've got an election coming up?
Yeah, there's a ballot initiative tomorrow to restrict abortion rights.
Mm-hmm.
It's really weird here in Albuquerque, and open early voting is open, you know, and has been. But it's a one-issue ballot, and it's very confusing how it's worded. So people want to be sure to vote against the initiative if they are pro-choice.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it. Yeah.
What's you know, it's interesting. I saw a on TV in my hotel room this morning. I just turned on the TV, said, what's going on in the news? And Andrea Mitchell was interviewing a woman, a Republican, who was a pro-choice Republican. And Andrea Mitchell said, what do you think about these forced ultrasounds? I mean, you know, she didn't use the phrase, but I will. It's basically state-sponsored rape. And the woman said, I am pro-life. I am, you know, opposed to abortions. I think that there should be significant restrictions on the abortions. But I get very, very uncomfortable when these male politicians start talking about shoving an ultrasound wand inside my body. I think that I don't think that that's the appropriate role of the state. And I'm curious, do you know if forced ultrasounds, you know, state-sanctioned rape is part of
it's a late-term restriction thing.
Oh, okay.
I don't know.
It's one on the spectrum. It's one of them. On the spectrum, it's one of the more rational ones, at least. But still.
Yeah, it's kind of. You know, I voted and I didn't even read the whole thing because it's like a full page of fine print, and I was just trying to figure out: do I want to vote for this initiative or against this initiative? Because it's very confusing. So I didn't. I think it might be more along the lines of providing all this information and, you know, making people look at gory photographs and you know, on and on. But
well, that's what the forced ultrasounds is. You know, you've got to look.
I don't think it has a forced ultrasound, or it probably would have been on the news more. But still, it's a creepy thing, and I don't know how it got on the ballot. And typically, the only people that show up to vote for these things are going to be the pro-lifers that got it on the ballot to begin with. You know, and everybody else doesn't even know what's going on because it's just a one-issue ballot. There's nothing else even with it. So it's
right. And you have to show up at an election site tomorrow, as opposed to mailing. You know, voting by mail.
I don't know if there's a mail-in option. I know there's early voting sites all over the place, and they're labeled out on the street with a sign, and you can vote anywhere. So it's just important to go vote against this thing if you're against it. If you're pro-choice.
Oh, okay.
You know, just take a few minutes and go.
Shano tells me it's a 20 week rule. It's one of these so-called fetal pain pieces. But
yes,
anyhow, Ben,
that sounds right.
Yeah, Ben, thanks for the heads up. I appreciate it. Thank you very much for the call. Cliff in Eastlake, Colorado, listening on AM 760, where I'm broadcasting out of today. Hey, Cliff, what's on your mind?
How you
Cliff,
doing, Tom?
Hey, you're on the air.
Yeah. You mentioned earlier on about free education.
Mm-hmm.
So I do believe that the teachers and the janitors and the administrators and the structural workers to build the school, they all work for free.
After World War II, when an entire generation of Americans came back from the war, my dad included, and Louise's dad included, they were given, through the GI Bill, they were given free tuition to college. And that doubled the number of highly educated people in America. That led to a revolution in America in terms of the development of the diode and then the transistor and then the integrated circuit, among other things, you know, just absolute revolutionary change, pharmaceuticals, all kinds of things came out of the fact that we had considered education part of the commons. Our roads are part of the commons. You don't pay to drive on the roads. The question you're asking, Cliff, is just as dumb, if I may respectfully use that word, as asking the question, okay, I'm going to drive free on, you know, Route 93 here. Does that mean that the guy who's building the road should do it for free?
Said that question one more time, please.
I said your question is the same. It makes as little sense as saying the road is free that I'm driving on. Therefore, should the guy who builds the road, who lays the asphalt, should he be working for free?
Yeah, but it's not free because we pay our taxes that go towards building the road.
That's right, and we pay our taxes that go for education.
Education, that means you have to raise taxes, right, once again.
May well be. I mean, the fact of the matter is the taxes are at a 60-year low right now, and particularly taxes on the wealthy. Of course. Of course. But, Cliff, if you hate your country so much that you want to see America continue going down this road, this third world road, where we're the only country in the world that doesn't have higher education that's available to people, or we're literally the only country in the world where there's $1 trillion worth of student debt. If you hate your country that much, I feel really sorry for you.
Once again, you put words in people's mouths, right?
I don't understand. You know, Thomas Jefferson created the first free college, the University of Virginia. He thought it was so important, he put it on his tombstone. He thought it was his proudest accomplishment, a free college. Abraham Lincoln created free colleges, over 60 free colleges all over the United States, the land-grant colleges, with the idea that they would be free, that our intellectual infrastructure is important. And I think, you know, trashing our intellectual infrastructure is not only intellectually dishonest, but it betrays a lack of understanding of what the commons is and what our country is. So, Cliff, respectfully, I disagree with you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
In fact, it was such a breathtaking notion that it took me a minute to... Is he really saying that? Yeah, I guess he was. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from AM 760, Colorado's Progressive Talk, where tomorrow night, Tuesday night, I will be at the Tattered Cover Bookstore. Free event, book signing, and for Crash of 2016. And then on from there, that's Tuesday. And then on Wednesday, I will be, let me get my list here. Wednesday, I'll be in Santa Monica. Thursday, I'll be in San Francisco. Friday, I'll be in Portland. And the following Tuesday in D.C. So you can find the whole schedule, all the times, all the places, at tomhartman.com. And Diana, in Altoona, Pennsylvania. You wanted to talk about Bernie running for president?
Yes.
Hi, Diana.
My name's Diana. Is that what you said?
I did.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I didn't understand you. I'm concerned. I love Bernie Sanders. I agree with just about everything he says. But I'm concerned that if he runs, he's just going to spoil it for the Democrat who's running, because these third-party people have to understand that the people that vote for them are going to be taken away from the Democratic Party as opposed to the Republican Party. They're going to be, you know, they're going to vote. You're going to get more people that are Democrats voting for them. And, you know what we're going to end up with.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll see.
Elizabeth Warren, too. I don't know too much. I haven't heard her, you know, speaking a lot. But, I mean, I take it I probably agree with her. Yeah. But they're smart enough. They should be smart enough to know that third-party candidates aren't going to win.
But third-party candidates can do us a really, really good job of pushing the other parties in the directions that they want them to move. I think the last time that a third-party candidate actually cost his party was when Teddy Roosevelt ran in the Bull Moose Party in 2012 and cost half the election, as I recall. I think that led to Woodrow Wilson.
With the people that backed Ralph Nader.
But Ralph Nader did not cause Al Gore to lose.
Because they took away from the Democrat, Al Gore, and look what we ended up with.
Well, but see, even if Ralph Nader hadn't been in that race, Ralph Nader did not cause Al Gore to lose. That has been demonstrated. What caused Al Gore to lose, first of all, he didn't lose. He won. But beyond, you know, when they recounted the vote in Florida, it turned out that Al Gore actually won Florida. Now, that was in the New York Times. But secondly, the thing that put Al Gore within spitting distance of George W. Bush, or vice versa, rather, that got George W. Bush close enough to Al Gore that he could steal Florida, was that his brother, Jeb Bush, had tossed 80,000 African Americans off the voting rolls, you know, just weeks before the election. And this is the sort of thing that we've been seeing in election after election after election. It's what Ken Cuccinelli just tried to do in Virginia. And you know, I'm not sure if the AG's race has been decided there yet or not. But I would be very surprised if you know, like I said, Teddy Roosevelt was a sitting president for a term and a half and was very, very popular. Taft was his hand-groomed guy. When he went out of town, Taft was basically his president. And ultimately he felt betrayed by Taft and launched a third party and the Bull Moose Party and ran against Taft in 2012, excuse me, 101 years ago today, and cost Taft the election and got Woodrow Wilson elected. But I can't imagine Bernie doing that. I think the net consequence of having somebody speaking the truth and talking back to middle of the road, in quotes, Democrats and Republicans, is a net good thing. But, you know, time will tell. We'll see. And my guess is also that Bernie is a smart enough guy, and he knows the importance of the Supreme Court, that if he thought that he was going to have that kind of impact, that he would probably change his tune. But I can't speak for him. We will find out as time goes on. He has not announced that he's running for president. What he has said is that if nobody else is raising the issues he's raising, that he would consider it. And that's a big difference. Diana, thank you for the call. Claudia in Deer Island, Maryland, or Deer Isle.
Deer Isle, Maine.
Maine, thank you.
Deer Isle, Maine.
Yeah, okay. You had some thoughts on Bernie. Yeah, you had some thoughts on Bernie.
Are you there?
I am. You're on the air.
Okay.
We're doing a kind of anything goes today, by the way. It's, you know, I'm on the road.
The first thought I had when you said that maybe Bernie might run was immediately Elizabeth Warren jumped to my mind, and I thought, what a great combination they would be, because it would motivate so many young people to vote who sort of feel cast aside. But I've got two other quick points, and I can be just as quick as I am right now.
That's
about
fine.
Them. One is, I would think you would be a really good guest on Max Kaiser's show, because I know you're on RT a lot. And I think it would be a great interview with having you come there and do your...
Max has been on my show a number of times.
Or vice versa, sure.
Yeah, he's been on our show a couple of times. I might have been on his show. I mean, he does his show out of Paris. I'm sorry. Our phone system, for some reason, just doesn't send audio. I doubt down the line very well. It never has, but we're always saying, can you hear me? We got to figure it out.
Yeah, I can now. Yeah, and the other thing was my sister, when we heard about all those tornadoes in the Midwest yesterday over a period of a few hours, and it came on really fast, her first reaction was HARP. And I know you don't talk very much about it, but, you know, there's a lot of us out here who are concerned that the weather is being changed deliberately by methods like that.
HARP is the, for people who don't know what you're talking about, HARP is the ultra-low frequency radiation, giant antenna arrays that are used to communicate with principally submarines, which are in places where normal radio waves won't penetrate water. But these very, very, very low-frequency waves will penetrate water and to a certain extent, soil. And so HARP is the, I forget what the acronym stands for, something, a large array, whatever. I'm concerned about HARP's effects, too. I don't see how it would affect weather, though. What's the mechanism?
Have you read that book, HAARP,
no.
by Jerry Smith?
No, I guess I have to do some education.
It's a really neat book, and explained it in great detail how it works.
Yeah, okay.
And,
all right, I'll check it out. Claudia, thank you for the tip, and thank you for the call. Great to
have
hear from
you. Have a great afternoon. Bye.
Thanks, you too. Billy Sue in Goleta, California. Hey, Billy Sue, what's up?
Hi, this is Bill.
Or Bill.
In Goleta, California, which is about 100 miles away from Santa Monica, and I hope to see you Wednesday.
Oh, wonderful.
I just wanted to point out that if our friend Elizabeth Warren were to run as a presidential candidate, she would be a Democrat, not a third party.
That's right.
And boy, could we sweep that race wonderfully if she were to run, because she's going to bring such good news to America. truthful news as opposed to Wall Street news.
Yeah, I am a huge supporter of Elizabeth Warren for president. But let's keep in mind, we're 3 years out. 3 years before 2008, nobody even knew who Barack Obama was. I mean, people knew who he was. He'd given a speech at the DNC, but nobody seriously thought of him as a presidential contender. And here he is, a two-term president. So there's a world of time between now and then. What we really need to be looking at is the 2014 elections, next year's elections, because those elections are going to influence. Now, they're not only going to set up 2016, but they're going to influence whether Congress is ever going to get its act together and get anything done, which is pretty amazing. Billy, thanks a lot for the call. Jerry in Long Island. Hey, Jerry.
Yeah, hi. I'd like to respond to what the previous caller, Diana, was talking about with respect to this whole idea that if Bernie Sanders ran as a third-party independent candidate, he would be a spoiler, which is something I completely disagree with. And, in fact, in my opinion, one of the biggest mistakes my fellow progressives make is to put all their eggs in one Democratic basket instead of forcing Democratic politicians to compete with independent party candidates for progressive votes and for progressive voters. I mean, are you still there?
I am. I'm listening.
Yeah, okay. I'm sorry. Yeah, I heard like a static on my line. I mean, after all, how are we supposed to get the Democratic politicians to pay attention to us if we allow them to just take our votes for granted on Election Day and ignore us the rest of the year? And as far as I'm concerned, Democratic politicians won't behave and they won't vote more progressively in Congress unless and until they fear losing progressive constituents' votes on Election Day instead of just this current practice where they take our votes for granted on Election Day and they just ignore us and our needs and concerns the rest of the year. This is why we're getting more of these so-called free trade agreements. This is why you have Democratic Party candidates even considering and Democratic politicians even considering making Republican sort changes to Social Security and Medicare and making cuts to these programs as well as cuts to Medicaid and to food stamps, only not as much as Republicans. I mean, I think that the only way to get the Democratic Party more progressive is to give them some competition, make them compete for a vote.
So Jerry, I get your point. And I think that there's a middle ground here. I don't think that the best strategy is to form the circular firing squad, is to go after the Democrats. I do think that the most important strategy is to infiltrate the Democratic Party, to show up, to participate, to become a precinct committee person, those kinds of things. That said, though, I do think that the Democratic Party's slogan in some areas, in some races, is basically, vote for us, we're not as bad as the Republicans. And that has to change. It has to be, and this is, frankly, some of this has to do with legislating. Most of it has to do with messaging. It has to be, vote for us, we're for the working person. Vote for us, we're standing up for your rights. Vote for us, we want to protect the Fourth Amendment. Vote for us, we want to stop the wars. Vote for us, we want to cut the Pentagon budget and rebuild America.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So I don't see it as either or. I see it as a political ecosystem, and I think third-party candidates and independent candidates have a role in that ecosystem, but we have to take over the Democratic. Welcome back. Sheila in Winchester, Virginia. Hey, Sheila, what's on your mind?
Tom, it is a great, great pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you.
I will not sit here and say that you're a god like Rush Limbaugh or a great patriot, but you are a very good person with the news. And I really, really, really appreciate everything you've done to let us all know about the TPP bill.
Yeah.
We need to keep calling our congressmen and legislatures.
Well, the good news is the 100 Democrats who signed a letter to the president opposed to it last week has now grown to 133 Democrats. And there's over 20 Republicans who have said that they will vote against fast-track authority in the House of Representatives. So, you know, a lot's going to depend on whether John Boehner, you know, whether Boehner decides to use this as a bargaining chip with the president. I mean, there's a whole lot of horse trading that's going to go on between now and then. But we can blow up that horse trading just like we did the war on, you know, the potential war with Syria. By speaking out. And I think, frankly, that's happening. I think we're in the middle of making that happen right now.
Well, I thank you very much. I don't know if I'm still on the air, but I just want to say thank you for that. And to your other caller, the best way to stop the Democrats and the Republicans from overriding us consumers is stop. It's the big corporations that are running the country, not the Republicans and the Democrats. Look who their backers are.
There you go. There you go. Sheila, thank you for the call. Very well said. Diane in San Jose, California, watching Free Speech TV. Hey, Diane, what's up?
Hi. Hi, Tom. I'm so excited about Bernie Sanders even thinking about running for president, you know?
Right. Yeah, he has always said, you know, I'm happy with the job I have, but I think he's right. If nobody is going to speak the truths that he speaks, even if it's such a long shot that there's no chance, it will get that conversation into the American mainstream, and that's an important point. That's an important thing to do.
Yeah, I know how he treats people. He's so fair. You know, I know you have to meet deadlines for time and stuff, but, you know, I think he's so wonderful, and I wanted him to know. I'm going to call him. I talked to him on the phone. He actually called me back when I told him, Tom, don't hang up, that there were 40 homeless encampments in Silicon Valley, you know?
Wow.
I mean, it breaks my heart. And I used to be a counselor for a homeless shelter 20 years ago. And sometimes I'd find myself just crying, you know, not in front of clients, but, you know, we really need people like Bernie Sanders. And I would fundraise for him. I used to fundraise. Anyway, sorry to get so emotional, but yeah, can you imagine 40 encampments in one of the richest areas
in the
United States?
Yeah. Yeah, I can. And it's a symptom of the tragedy of the American economy. Diane, thank you for your passion. Thank you for your call. Thank you for your concern. And you know, call Bernie's office and encourage him. He needs to hear our feedback. Diane, thank you so much. We'll be back with the Talk Radio News Service right after this. True People's Media, the Tom Harbin program. Welcome back, and let's check in with Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service at the White House, brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com. Hey, Victoria, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Well, I thought you might find this interesting. Senator Elizabeth Warren has been giving a speech on the Senate floor. She may still be giving it from her prepared remarks. I'll give you two excerpts about chain CPI.
Mm-hmm.
Supporters of chain CPI say that it's a more accurate way of measuring cost of living increases for seniors. That statement is simply not true. Chain CPI falls short of the actual increases in cost that seniors face, pure and simple. Chain CPI is just a fancy way of saying cut benefits.
She's right.
Then she goes on to talk about Social Security. In some length, and she says the last thing we should do is allow the program to be dismantled inch by inch. She goes on to say that is why we should be talking about expanding Social Security benefits, not cutting them.
She's right.
And she mentioned Senator Harkin, Senator Begich, Senator Sanders, and others have been pushing hard in that direction. Social Security is incredibly effective, it is incredibly popular, and the calls for strengthening it are growing louder every day.
That is marvelous. I'm so glad to hear that Elizabeth Warren is speaking out like that.
So I thought I'd start off on a positive note.
Indeed. Well, thank you for doing that. What else is up?
President Obama is going to host key senators tomorrow and offer an update on the status of talks with Iran. These are leading senators, top Democrats and Republicans on the Banking Committee, Foreign Relations, Armed Services, and the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. Vice President Joe Biden, Secretary of State John Kerry met them last week, but now the president's going to weigh in, and he'll talk about the upcoming negotiations as well.
And Secretary of State John Kerry today pressed Iran to finalize an agreement, also saying that he hoped that Iran will understand the importance of coming to Geneva, prepared to create a document that can prove to the world this is a peaceful program. Said, I'm not going to negotiate in public. And the meetings start in Geneva on Wednesday.
Wow.
Jay Carney talked in the briefing about this number of 80% that came out over the weekend in the Washington Post as being a number that administration officials have settled on as being a target that is okay for the number of people that they will accept as having navigated the website, the federal healthcare website, successfully once it's fixed. In other words, 2 out of 10 failures to access it, they will consider a success.
Has there been any? I've seen on some right wing websites almost like advertising the fact that there is a tool that you can download to your computer that will cause your computer in the background to every minute or so hit the Obamacare website, and you know apparently hundreds of thousands of right wingers have downloaded this thing, and because it's not a continuous stream of denial of service from your own individual computer, it's just happening once a minute. You're not technically breaking the law. You know, it's not really a denial of service attack, but because hundreds of thousands of right wingers are doing this, it is a denial of service attack, and it is damaging the website and bringing it down. Have you heard any more about that?
I haven't heard any more about that. I've just heard scattered reports of it, and I don't know what they can do about it, quite honestly.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know what they can do about it.
Build a more robust platform, which certainly they're working on right now.
Yes, yes. Yeah. A bipartisan group of House members is demanding a new report from the State Department on how hundreds of millions of dollars are being spent to help Haiti recover from the 2010 earthquake that killed about 230,000 people. The legislation is being spearheaded by Representative Barbara Lee, Democrat of California, and it's in response to a June report from the Government Accountability Office, the GAO, and it found that as of March this year, USAID had spent less than one-third of the $651 million that Congress appropriated for Haiti relief efforts. But what's weird is that the State Department's reporting requirement ended in September last year, and as a result, Congress doesn't know what's happening to the money.
Uh-oh.
And
Is Halliburton involved?
No, but Barbara Lee wants to know.
Yeah.
Where's
the
money?
Right.
Is it being spent, and how is it being spent?
Right.
Because the Haitian people are still suffering.
Oh yeah, yeah. And now we have the Philippines and more to come as the weather gets weirder. I mean, you know, now we've got Indiana and Illinois for that matter.
Exactly. Three House Republicans have proposed the elimination of language in the Constitution that gives Congress the power to collect income taxes. Resolution
the 13th Amendment? Or no, that's not the 13th.
The 16th Amendment.
16th Amendment, thank you.
Representative Jim Bridenstine of Oklahoma wants to repeal the 16th Amendment. He says it contradicts the 4th Amendment.
How?
Because as the 4th Amendment guarantees the right of people to be secure in their houses, he says it negates the 4th Amendment, and so it should be repealed and the IRS should be eliminated.
That's a stretch.
It is a stretch, but they're going to have a go.
Yeah. I mean, rather than building a constitutional argument, doesn't it make more sense to just say, you know, we have a constituency for this, abolish the IRS? But then the question, of course, is what are you going to replace it with?
Well, exactly. Well, he says just raise taxes when you need them and doesn't really think that you do. So.
Yeah. Sell Yellowstone to the Koch brothers.
Yeah. Dozen House Democrats have proposed legislation that would require the government to pay back low-income contract workers who were placed on furlough during the government shutdown in October.
Good.
This is Delegate Eleanor Holmes Norton is proposing this, saying that she would direct back pay to low-income contract workers who need it most.
Except this is for the people who need it most, so therefore John Boehner probably will not allow a vote on it, right?
Yeah, there's no word yet on whether it will go anywhere at all.
Yeah, okay. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Victoria, thank you for coming by.
Thank you.
We'll be right back. We're going to talk with Lamar Waldron about who killed John Kennedy, how, why, what's the real story. Our next hour. Stick around.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends. Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. Edison Factor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at stamps.com and our website, tomhartman.com. You support our programs and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at tomhartman.com. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And in just a moment, Lamar Waldron is going to drop by for the entire hour. We're going to be talking about the Kennedy assassination. He has a new book about it. And, of course, he and I wrote a couple of other books about it. But first, I just have a call that's been on hold here for some time. Nick, in Kenosha, Wisconsin, from the topic that I'm seeing, I didn't want you to not get on the air today. So, Nick, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom. Just to let you know, my daughter was a very big fan of yours, and she came back from Iraq in 2009, was disfigured, and, yesterday would have been her 26th birthday, and the only time I seen her smile since she ever came back from Iraq actually was when Bernie Sanders had called her back, and we're not even his constituents, and said to her that he's doing the best he can, and wished her the best of luck.
Wow.
And it wasn't for her vote, obviously. We live in Wisconsin.
Right.
And I believe this is the kind of people we really need leading us now, somebody that cares about us.
Yeah, I agree. And what happened with your daughter?
She committed suicide on November 1st, and yesterday would have been her birthday. And kept everything to herself. And she was. I'm a retired vet too.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry, it's kind of hard.
I can imagine.
And she was always telling me, "Goes, Dad, you don't understand what they were making us do over there. You don't understand what they were making us do."
Yeah.
And God knows what was going on with these kids over there.
Yeah.
But when I see somebody like ICE on TV worried about four people in Benghazi, how about 4,500 of our people and these innocent civilians?
Yeah. 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 I'm with you. Nick, thank you for the call, and thank you for sharing that story both with me and with our listeners and viewers. And my heart goes out to you. I can't imagine what it must be like to lose a child. It's not how it's supposed to be.
Well, there's other parents like us. I mean, I was my only kid, and I really miss my kid, Tom. And it's just I could imagine what other parents are going through, too. And watching that war criminal Cheney and his daughter on TV is just it's just insane.
Yeah, yeah, you know? It really is. Nick, I wish you the best. You'll be on my prayer list tonight. Thank you for calling.
Thank you, Tim.
Bye now.
Thank
you. Lamar Waldron, speaking of untimely deaths, is on the line with us. He's an historian, an author. His most recent book, The Hidden History of the JFK Assassination, and co-author with me on two books that covered the JFK assassination, Legacy of Secrecy and Ultimate Sacrifice. And the website, thehiddenhistoryofthejfkassassination.com. Surprise, surprise, the title of the book, complete with the. So, The Hidden History of the JFK Assassination.com. Lamar, it's great to have you back in the program. Welcome back.
Great to be with you again, Tom.
So you have a new book out about the Kennedy assassination. Of course, this the 50th anniversary is coming up, what, Friday?
That's correct.
Yeah. And so let's just get into this. I mean, you know, 50 years have passed. You've written two books about Kennedy's murder. There's probably 1,000 other ones out there in the marketplace. What new information do you have that's in your new book, The Hidden History of the JFK Assassination?
Well, we've got several things. Probably the most important thing is that we now have incredible details about exactly how JFK was killed, who was doing the actual shooting, where those people came from, and where they went to.
Okay, and let's go through it. How was he killed? Who was doing the shooting? Where'd they come from?
Well, basically what we have now, let me kind of explain where this information came from, is in 1985, America's most powerful godfather was finally in federal prison. And that man's name was Carlos Marcello. Louisiana, most of Texas, the lower half of Mississippi, America's most powerful godfather for decades. And the Kennedys had been trying to put Marcello in prison for many, many years, until JFK died. Bobby even tried after JFK died. They were unsuccessful. By 1985, he was finally in federal prison thanks to an undercover FBI operation that came about under the Carter administration. And so he was in prison. And the FBI was able to get an FBI informant close to Marcello. In fact, very close to Marcello. They got this FBI informant in the prison cell with Carlos Marcello. They made him Carlos Marcello's roommate. And then they got a court authorization to put a bugged transistor radio in the jail cell. So every night, every morning, Marcello is in that cell, and he's talking to a man he thinks is his best friend by the name of Jack Van Lanningham. And Jack Van Lanningham was older than the average inmate. The average inmate was in their 20s. Marcello was 75. Marcello was, Jack Van Lanningham was in his 40s, I believe, at that time. And so because he was so close in age to Marcello, they had struck up a friendship even before they were cellmates. And you should understand, Jack Van Lanningham was not a criminal. He was not the typical man you would find in a federal prison. He was an ordinary family man, a successful businessman, in fact, who had literally had one bad day. And because of that one bad day, his troubled alcoholic wife had left him. And that sent Jack on a downward spiral. And so he went from being this successful businessman, family man. Long story short, he winds up in Tampa, no money, drinking heavily. One bad day, he tries to rob a bank with a bag of dirty laundry and a television remote control, you know, saying it's a bomb mm-hmm. and a detonator. Mm-hmm. Like you or I would if we committed a crime. He felt so guilty later on, he called up the FBI and said, I feel terrible about this. You know, I'd like to turn myself in. And they said, you know, we'd like that too. Why don't you, you know, come right on in. I tell you what, why don't you stay there? We'll go pick you up and we'll take care of this.
Jack, well, by the way, I have to add, Jack is a very decent guy. I had lunch with him. I had dinner with him about 3 months ago in Los Angeles.
Right. And he's, so again, it is important to understand.
He's still alive.
A criminal guy, except for that one bad thing. But he wound up with an 8-year prison sentence. Hmm. So he had no choice at all but to help the FBI. That was the only way he was getting out of prison, in less than 2 years. Mm-hmm. So, what he then, did, he gets Marcello, you know, talking about a wide variety of crimes. And this, and I want to emphasize that this was a really, extensive FBI undercover operation. It was codenamed Camtex, Camtex. And it would last for 2 years. Jack Van Lanningham would be part of it for a year. Like I said, they had the bug transistor radio. And Marcello made an outburst in the prison yard in front of Jack, whom he trusted, and another inmate who used to work for his brother, whom he trusted. And he just blurted out, and this has been in our previous book, Legacy of Secrecy, the one that Leonardo DiCaprio is turning into a movie with Robert De Niro. And Marcello said, you know, I'm glad I had JFK killed. I wish I could have done it myself. Well, what's new in the book is a couple of days later, Jack was curious, as would you or I be. You know, he's heard this confession out in the prison yard. By the way, that night that Marcello made the confession in the prison cell, and this would be on FBI undercover audio tape, should they ever decide to release it, Marcello did, you know, nicely threaten Jack never to talk about what Marcello had blurted out in the prison yard about having killed JFK.
Mm-hmm.
A couple of days later, Jack, very, very curious, he knows he can't ask Marcello directly, but he also knows Marcello well enough to know that Marcello hated the Kennedys, and all he had to do was get Marcello talking about the Kennedys again. And sure enough, Marcello, who now knows Jack, knows that he had had JFK killed, starts revealing more details. And Marcello goes into detail, and he talks about how he imported two hitmen from Europe to come to America through Canada into Michigan, where you used to live, Tom, from Michigan down to Louisiana, to this huge multi-thousand-acre estate that Marcello had outside of New Orleans 10 days before the
assassination. Amazing. Hang on. Lamar Waldron is with us. His new book, The Hidden History of the JFK Assassination.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be back with more of Lamar Waldron. We're about halfway through the fifth of the first question, but we'll get there. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you. 20 minutes past the hour. Lamar Waldron on the line with us, the author of The Hidden History of the JFK Assassination. The website, The Hidden History of the JFK Assassination.com. So, Lamar, Carlos Marcello, the mob boss, the FBI had figured it out, all that kind of thing. We've got the tapes, blah, blah, blah. And Jack Van Lanningham had nailed him. He was talking about bringing in a couple of shooters from out of town.
That's right. And 10 days before the assassination, they're at his huge Churchill Farms estate, which is multi-thousand
Who's they?
Acres outside of New Orleans.
Who's they who are at his church, at his estate?
The two hitmen from Italy.
I see. Okay.
And they're taking target practice there. You know, Marcello's talking about this in the prison cell with Van Lanningham. And then, shortly before the assassination in Dallas, Marcello's number two lieutenant in Dallas comes over, a Dallas restaurateur by the name of Joe Campisi Sr. And Joe Campisi Sr. has figured into many assassination things before because he was very much known, the House Select Committee on Assassinations in the late 1970s, which was the fifth of six government committees to investigate JFK's murder. There was much more than the Warren Commission, of course. You know, they had looked closely at Joe Campisi Sr. Well, now we know he's actually the guy who went to New Orleans, took the two hitmen, and he took them back to Dallas to hide in his restaurant. Now, Tom, you and I have eaten at Campisi's restaurant before.
Yes, and they smashed up our car with a hammer.
Well, let's not. We don't know that happened.
Somebody did. Somebody did outside.
I'm sure that was just a coincidence.
Yes.
And at that time, Campisi's. So in 1963, it was well known by investigators. Jack Ruby ate there the night before the assassination. So now we know Jack Ruby was at that restaurant. Also, the two hitmen were at that restaurant. And then the following day, the day of the assassination, on November the 22nd, a Friday, just like it is this year, the two hitmen were taken by Campisi to Dealey Plaza. We don't know, so who was shooting from behind, who was shooting from the knoll, but these two hitmen were there. After the assassination, Marcello told Van Lanningham, the two shooters went back to Campisi's restaurant. They hid out there. And then once things had cooled down a little bit, they went back to Louisiana, back up through Michigan, and back into Canada. Now, that's where that part of the story ends for Marcello. Based on 25 years' worth of research into Carlos Marcello, I would be shocked if those two hitmen left Canada alive, or if they did leave Canada alive, that they weren't killed pretty quickly thereafter. Mm. And we know that because independently I was able to verify from another a mobster's memoir, a man who was linked to Jimmy Hoffa's death, Frank Sheeran, that Marcello, not just for this hit, not just for the JFK hit, but for other hits, he liked to import war orphans from Italy because that way, after the hit, they could be disposed of themselves, and there was no one to to mourn them, so to speak.
Marcello himself was Italian. He was a Sicilian immigrant.
That's right. He was born in Tunisia of Sicilian parents, and that was one of Marcello's big problems. He was on trial on federal charges in New Orleans the whole month of November 63. He was a target, a big target of John Robert Kennedy's huge war against organized crime, and even a small conviction against Marcello would have resulted in his deportation. They'd already tried to deport him once in April 61. Had him taken to Guatemala, birth certificate.
If I can get, bring us back to some other little sure. tight points here, there are people who say it was the CIA. There's others who say it was the military-industrial complex. There's others who say it was the Cuban refugees, or not refugees, whatever.
Cuban exiles.
Exiles. Thank you. You're saying it was the mob, but?
Well, it was the mob plus the CIA.
Right.
And there were Cuban exiles involved, because there have been several articles about my new book. But if you look at articles in the mainstream media today about the assassination, they're distinguished by two things. One, they pretend the government investigation began and ended with the Warren Commission, and it didn't. The House Select Committee on Assassinations concluded in 1979 that Marcello and his associate in Tampa, Tampa godfather Santo Trafficante, had the motive, means, and opportunity to have killed JFK. And that congressional committee officially concluded JFK was killed by a conspiracy. But if you look at all the conspiracy articles in the mainstream media, they try to break it down as if, well, was it the mafia? Was it the CIA? Was it Cuban exiles? As if those
what if it was all three?
Different things. And you and I have been saying since the early 90s, wait a minute, it's not like these are different things entirely.
Right.
Because what people overlook is people like Carlos Marcello, people like his associate Santo Trafficante, who also confessed late in life, people like their mutual associate in the assassination, Johnny Roselli, the Chicago Mafia's man in Hollywood and Las Vegas. Roselli also confessed late in life to his attorney. Those three gentlemen were all working for the CIA.
Right.
From 1960, when Richard Nixon, as vice president, had them hired by the CIA to kill Fidel Castro, into 1963.
And then you've got the lower-level guys like Bernard Barker.
Well, that's right.
David Morales.
You've got your three top guys are working for the CIA to try to kill Fidel Castro. That's what the CIA thinks. You've got lower-level people like Bernard Barker, like David Morales, the head of operations at the huge Miami CIA station, who confessed, by the way, Morales confessed, a guy by the name of John Martino, who worked for Trafficante and Roselli, he confessed his role. So all of those people, including Bernard Barker, were working on what is called the CIA Mafia plots to kill Fidel Castro,
right,
which a CIA official by the name of Richard Helms had continued into 1963 without telling John or Robert Kennedy, or even their own CIA director. JFK's CIA director didn't even know that the CIA, specifically this guy Richard Helms, was working with the mafia to kill Fidel Castro, but the mob was really using that to cover their plans to assassinate John F. Kennedy.
Amazing. Lamar Waldron is with us. He's the author of a new book, The Hidden History of the JFK Assassination. The website, thehiddenhistoryofthejfkassassination.com. We'll be back with more of Lamar.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And if you're in the Denver area, get over to the Tattered Cover tomorrow night at 7:30. Wednesday, Santa Monica. Thursday, San Francisco, etc. So we're coming up on the 50th anniversary of the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. And Lamar Waldron has a new book out about it, The Hidden History of the JFK Assassination. .com is the website. The book, of course, is of that title. And Lamar, welcome back.
Great to be back with you, Tom.
So we have established that this mafia boss, Carlos Marcello, was largely responsible for this assassination, that he brought in the shooters, that he hit him at Joe Campisi's restaurant, that Jack Ruby was involved, et cetera. Okay, we're up to this point.
And I want to emphasize that the CIA people that were working for and with Marcello were critical to allowing these mob bosses to kill JFK in a way that would force high U.S. government officials, including Robert Kennedy, to cover up important facts about JFK's murder at the time, not just then, but for months, years, even decades to follow.
Right. And so the question that everybody always asks, who is Lee Harvey Oswald?
Well,
and did, you know, what was his role?
Well, Lee Harvey Oswald, when you look at him in isolation, he can look very suspicious, right? But your listeners should ask themselves. So the Warren Commission could never, no one's ever come up with a motivation for Oswald. Anything you ever read in a book or see in a movie or see on TV is just made up.
Well, there's the picture of him with a rifle and the two socialist newspapers.
Sure. And the Warren Commission, the best they could do for motivation was say, well, he was a communist Marxist from the time he was a teenager, so his Marxist ideology must have been why he killed JFK.
Right.
But your listeners should ask themselves. In the 1950s, even if you weren't old enough, if you've read about the 1950s, pretty conservative time, right? McCarthy, Vice President Nixon. Well, how many teenage communists were joining the United States Marines in the 1950s? He had joined the Civil Air Patrol first. Not only joined the U.S. Marines, he wanted to join the Marines so badly, he tried to join before he was even old enough. And get this, once he was in the United States Marines, he walked around spouting a love of everything Russian, so much during the height of the Cold War that his fellow Marines called him Oswaldskovich. And yet, even when he was stationed at the U-2 spy plane base of the CIA's in Japan, guess how many times his Marine sergeants ever wrote him up for spouting his love of all things Russian?
Zero.
Exactly.
In other words, Oswald was our guy who was
exactly.
going to infiltrate on behalf of the CIA, was going to infiltrate Russia.
Right, and he was one of six young men that went over there around the same time. Five of them came back around the same time, those five with Russian wives. And as we were able to find out, naval intelligence was monitoring Oswald the whole time because he was their man. They wanted to see how the KGB in America would try to recruit Lee Harvey Oswald.
Okay, so he was working for naval intelligence, not the CIA.
Exactly. Well, yeah. Naval intelligence and the CIA, because remember, the CIA had that U-2 base. So when he was recruited, it was naval intelligence and the CIA.
And John Tower helped him come back.
And so... Oswald is back in America. He's the KGB. They're too smart. They realize he's some sort of a plant. They don't try to recruit him. So eventually he gets involved with a couple of associates of Marcello, who were also working for the CIA, in low-level Cuban operations. So the day of the assassination, Oswald thinks he's trying to get to Cuba. Now, again, when you look at Oswald in isolation, he can look suspicious, but many of your listeners, not all, don't realize JFK was almost killed in Chicago during his motorcade there 3 weeks before Dallas. That motorcade was in such danger, JFK had to cancel his entire trip. An ex-Marine in Chicago, with a lot of parallels to Oswald, was actually arrested that morning, and he worked at a tall warehouse overlooking JFK's motorcade route. And he was arrested with a carload of weapons. Then JFK was almost killed in Tampa, Florida. You and I were the first people to discover that attempt after going through, remember all those thousands of pages of newspaper microfilm we went through?
I spent hours and hours staring at microfilm.
We spent hours, and we finally found the one little article that slipped out the day after JFK died that said, oh, 4 days ago when JFK was on November the 18th, this is the 50th anniversary of that, JFK was almost killed in Tampa. And I talked to the Tampa chief of police. He said, we told JFK, you got to cancel your motorcade. We can't protect you. JFK went ahead with it. Well, there was a Tampa suspect, Fair Play for Cuba Committee associate by the name of Gilberto Lopez. And he had more than a dozen parallels to Oswald. So what we see here is not three plans to kill JFK, one plan, three cities, three different men who would have been the patsy for it. And Marcello, to Jack Van Landingham, admitted meeting Lee Harvey Oswald. But what we have to realize is Marcello was part of the CIA mafia plots to kill Fidel Castro on a very low level. Lee Harvey Oswald was part of that same plotting. The day of the assassination, he thought he was going to Mexico, and from Mexico he could get into Cuba as part of, you know, his being a low-level U.S. intelligence asset. Now, what the mafia was able to do with the help of their CIA associates like Morales, Bernard Barker, and John Martino is to plant phony evidence pointing at Fidel Castro. And that phony evidence convinced Lyndon Johnson, convinced JFK's CIA director, convinced people working on those Cuban operations like Alexander Haig, who later on became Reagan's Secretary of State, and even today
Secretary of State John Kerry, and I'm a big admirer of John Kerry. Hey, I voted for him. Think how great the country would have been if he'd been elected. But John Kerry has said three things on television recently. He said, number one, he believed in a conspiracy that killed JFK. Very, very brave thing for any official to say, right, Tom?
Yeah, especially Secretary of State.
Right, a sitting Secretary of State said, that's rare. Unfortunately, he did indicate, and you can see this on NBC Friday night when they're going to play the entire clip, but it's been played on the news even now. He kind of points the finger at Cuba as somehow being involved in JFK's murder. Now, again, give John Kerry credit. He says, look, I haven't looked into this a whole lot, but he sort of implies that Cuba was somehow behind Oswald's action. Well, the House Select Committee on Assassination looked into Cuba and Castro, and they determined Castro was not involved in the assassination. And a lot of the evidence, in fact, all the evidence implicating Fidel was discredited by the CIA and by the FBI back in 1964. Mm-hmm. What we also show in this new book, what I'm able to show now, is that phony evidence can all be traced to those three mob bosses who confessed and their associates in the CIA who also made credible confession. Mm-hmm. But look at what we're faced with today is we have this Cold War with Cuba. And our relations with Cuba have been frozen like a block of ice since JFK's murder. And it's now clear that the reason that we're still enemies with Cuba on a country-to-country basis, when we've made peace, America's made peace with former enemies like Vietnam, former enemies like China, who fought us during the Korean War, but we haven't made peace with Cuba, and we don't have trade with Cuba. And your listeners, even when it's really cold in the winter, they can't jet down to Cuba and lay on a nice beach because high U.S. officials from LBJ to John Kerry have erroneously believed that phony evidence planted by the mafia and their CIA allies
the Castro
back in 1963. Yeah. That's correct.
So back to the question, who was Oswald? You answered that. What role did he play on November 22nd?
Well, you know, again, according to Marcello in prison, he had two professional hitmen to come over and shoot JFK. They're not going to use someone like Oswald. When Oswald was in the Marines, some of your listeners may hear Oswald called a marksman sometime. That makes him sound like a crack shot, a good sniper, right?
That's something every Marine has to do. You have to get your marksmanship.
It's the lowest. Marksman is the lowest of three levels and includes things like sharpshooter and stuff. And when Oswald was in the Marines and practicing regularly, he would sometimes not just miss the bullseye, but the entire target. So there's no way.
Oh, Jesse Ventura tried to recreate the shot, and he actually is a professional shooter, you know, Navy SEAL. He couldn't do it.
Right. And no one's ever really been able to, on the first try, ever recreate that shooting. So Oswald, like I said, he would miss the entire target sometimes when he was practicing. So the
So Oswald was sitting in the cafeteria, according to a police officer who was there and a couple of other people. He actually was sitting in the cafeteria. He was the patsy.
Well, he was encountered just seconds after the assassination. Now there's evidence that's in the book. It's in several books, but it's pretty new evidence that shows that if Oswald had been on the sixth floor where the so-called sniper's nest is, he would have had to have gone down a stairwell because the power was off and the elevators weren't working. Now there are two female witnesses, one who talked to authorities at the time, who were on that stairwell, and they didn't see Oswald. So you're right. Oswald was exactly where he said he was. He was in that lunchroom. He was near a payphone. He was waiting to make or receive a call about going to the Texas Theater, John Martino, the CIA asset who also worked for Trafficante. When he confessed, he said Oswald was supposed to meet his contact that day in the Texas Theater. He would have been taken out of the country, not to get to Mexico and to Cuba, but he would have been killed. But it was important to have him to blame for the assassination.
Right. Because so he was literally the patsy.
He was literally the patsy. And the mob, Marcello and Trafficante, knew they had to have that because when they had assassinated the attorney general-elect of Alabama in 1954, they didn't have a patsy. And Eisenhower, in a rare move against organized crime, called out the National Guard to go into the little city, Phoenix City, Alabama, where the mob had assassinated the attorney general-elect of Alabama, which, by the way, there is a myth that says the mob doesn't kill government officials, and that's true for some mob families, but for Marcello's mafia, Trafficante's mafia, and the Chicago mafia.
Well, and this was, you know, I mean, the way the mob kills people is, you know, like Albert Anastasia. I mean, they do it publicly and they do it with guns. If the CIA wanted Jack Kennedy dead, he would have just not woken up one day. I mean, you know, and logic would indicate.
He was totally killed gangland style. But,
yeah.
But I have to say, there is hope for your listeners. And when we come back,
okay,
we'll tell them.
And Danielle and Shano are going to do the last 15 minutes of the show here and ask you that, because I've got to run to a TV studio. So thank you, Lamar. I'm going to put you on hold here. The Hidden History of the JFK Assassination.com is the website. The Hidden History is the book. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And if you're in the Denver area, I'll be at the Tattered Cover tomorrow night at 7:30. You can check out the entire schedule over at TomHartman.com for the crash of 2016.
Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Obviously, I am not Tom Hartman, but thankfully, Lamar Waldron, the author of The Hidden History of the JFK Assassination, as well as the co-author with Mr. Tom Hartman of several books. Lamar, I've been listening intently to the amazing story you've laid out over the last 45 minutes, and I think me as well as the audience would love for you to pick that up and continue with what you were just talking about with Tom. So please, by all means, the air is yours.
Well, thank you very much. And again, we'll go back to John Kerry, because he said three things. You know, he said this past week that made news. One was that he believed JFK was killed by a conspiracy, and then that he did think that Cuba was somehow involved. And again, as I pointed out, that's not really the case, and all that has been debunked. But here's why Kerry and other high officials have been able to think that for so many years, is because more than a million pages of JFK assassination records, according to NBC News, that's not my figure, that's NBC News, are still secret 50 years after JFK's murder. A law was passed in 1992, the JFK Act. It was passed in response to the excellent movie by Oliver Stone, JFK, and that created a groundswell of desire to release all the JFK files. No one could have guessed in 1992 that 4.5 million pages of files would be released. Nobody thought there were that many, but there's still a million pages, according to NBC News and according to a respected Washington think tank, OMB Watch. And so when you've got a million pages of files, 50 years after the assassination, deemed too sensitive to release, and among those files are the FBI undercover audio tapes of Godfather Carlos Marcello talking about these two shooters, talking about how he controlled Jack Ruby, talking about his meeting with Lee Harvey Oswald. Now, luckily, you know, we know what Marcello said, because I talked to the FBI informant. I was the first person to find just under 100 pages of uncensored FBI files about that secret undercover operation. I talked to the FBI supervisor, to the lead agent. But, you know, we should have Marcello's own words. He was 75. The agent that heard every tape said Marcello was not senile. He had all of his faculties with him. That's what Jack Van Lanningham said. But let's get the tapes. Let's listen to them. But even though the law says they should be released, they haven't been. Now, what the third thing John Kerry said that's very important, though, and he's going to say it on television this Friday night on NBC, but that clip is already, you can see that on the NBC website, is he says that all of the JFK assassination files should probably now be released. He said they should be released at some point, and that point has probably already passed.
Now,
he's right.
What can people listening, or people who have an interest in following, you know, the JFK assassination and continuing this investigation, what can they do to help push to get those documents and those tapes released?
Well, for another 2 weeks, they can go to the Hidden History of the JFK Assassination.com, and I have a link. There's not much on the website now. There will be in the coming weeks, but it's important to go there now and bookmark it and tell your friends, because there is a link to a White House petition that I started just a few days ago, and most people are hearing about this petition just for the first time on this show, and it calls for all of the JFK assassination files to be released. So if you would like to see these files released now and not in 4 years or in 10 years, the CIA in a recent court case said they reserve the right to keep those files secret past the 2017 date when they're all supposed to be released. Well, we shouldn't have to wait till 2017. We shouldn't have to wait another year. It's been 50 years. So if you want to get these files, no matter who, you know, your listeners believe who killed JFK, you know, I'm saying it's the mafia and some help from the CIA, and there are more CIA people I identify in the new book. You know, but if you think it's someone else, fine. Let's get all those files released. They shouldn't be allowed to keep these files secret. And so if people go to the hidden history of the JFK assassination.com, and they should sign, follow the link, go to the White House petition. I should say this. If you go to the White House website and you search for the petition with the terms JFK or assassination, you can't find it.
Interesting.
So you have to follow that link. There's one other very important thing. That petition also calls for a pardon for ex-Secret Service agent Abraham Bolden. Now, for your listeners who don't know who Bolden was, he's a pioneer, as a civil rights pioneer. He was chosen personally by JFK to be the first black presidential Secret Service agent. He found a lot of problems in the Secret Service. There was a scandal with the Secret Service just a week ago with Obama's presidential detail. There was a big scandal a year or two ago down in South America. Turns out they've been having these problems since 1963. In fact, a lot of the agents in JFK's detail were out drinking until 4, 5, 6 a.m. the night before he died. Abraham Bolden went to Washington to tell the Warren Commission about the Secret Service laxity and the attempts to kill JFK in Tampa 4 days before Dallas, and in Chicago 3 weeks before Dallas. The mafia framed Bolden. Bolden was arrested when he went to Washington before he could even talk to the Warren Commission staff, and served years in prison on clearly false charges. The main accuser against Bolden admitted later he committed perjury. Bolden's judge was biased and told the jury Bolden was guilty before they even went for their deliberation.
Lamar, it really is such an amazing story, and I want to remind everybody they can go to the hidden history of the JFK assassination.com to sign those petitions and check out your new book. I know how much Tom speaks well of your work and your working with you, Lamar. Thank you so much for taking a few minutes to talk with me as well.
Thank you so much. I appreciate the chance.
Lamar Waldron, The Hidden History of JFK Assassination, and Tom will be back broadcasting live from Denver tomorrow. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Tag, you're it.
Listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman Program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. Edison Factor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. Angie'sList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at Angie'sList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartman.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartman.com. Thank you.